This is Ozarks at Large for Wednesday, June 18th, 2014. I'm Antoinette Grajeda.
And I'm Christina Karnatz. Ahead on this edition of Ozarks, the Springdale Chamber of Commerce announces a program to create new jobs. Also, Roby Brock from Talk Business and Politics speaks with Jonathan Martin, national political correspondent for the New York Times.
Plus, for our monthly Spaces series, we tour the Tulsa National Weather Service office. And we talk to a U of A professor about an increase in extreme rain events and more. But first, Arkansas health officials laid the groundwork and announced a timeline for major changes to the private option to a legislative oversight committee yesterday. Initial steps presented for a February launch center around cost sharing. Arkansas Surgeon General Joe Thompson says the expectation is expanding co-pays and mandating enrollment in a plan that in some ways resembles a health savings account will lead to less costly health care decisions.
Interest in being punitive on people inappropriately utilizing care is somewhat misguided. These are folks that have never had resources to be able to engage in an effective way with the healthcare system. What this does is it gives us an ability to give them a window in.
Thompson says those changes bring the state into relatively uncharted territory, requiring federal approval.
Putting cost sharing on individuals that make only $5,700 a year total is a significant stretch for the Federal Center for Medicaid and Medicare Services.
Advocates of the changes, which also include limits to non-emergency transportation and enrollment in a program resembling health savings accounts, argue cost sharing leads to better consumer-driven healthcare decisions. Thompson characterized the cost of implementation as marginal, but says it's an open question if the benefit changes will lead to a better utilization of healthcare services.
The new executive director of Arkansas's health insurance marketplace, Cheryl Smith, introduced herself to members of a legislative oversight committee yesterday. Smith previously worked as the director of Utah's Exchange, created before the Affordable Care Act. She is tasked with exploring transitioning the state's health insurance marketplace from a state-federal partnership into a state-run exchange. Smith declined to comment on what she expects the health insurance exchange will need to look like, but says she will have an answer in the future.
I think it would be inappropriate for us to answer that question right now without asking the people of Arkansas what they actually need. So we will be conducting, over the next few months, focus groups, in-depth interviews, and a statewide survey.
Arkansas fell below enrollment projections and the national average for those receiving subsidies for private insurance under the federal health care reform. Just more than 16% of those eligible, or more than 40,000 residents enrolled. Answering questions from Stephanie Flowers, a Democratic senator from Pine Bluff, Smith said she's in the process of hiring staff with an expected cost of $3.5 million from federal sources. Smith also worked for the Conservative Heritage Foundation.
Officials at the Ozark St. Francis National Forest are calling attention to pollinating species for National Pollinator Week. Park planner Steve Duzan says three-fourths of the world's flowering plants depend on pollinators, and they have a big impact on Arkansas's agriculture. This makes pollinators like bees, butterflies, and a host of other species an important part of the economy. Hendricks College biologist Matt Moran says while pollinators face population declines nationally, Arkansas's unique ecological diversity has helped it fare better than most states.
We have a lot of protected land as well, so we still retain a lot of our native plant cover. And because of that, you have a lot of native species are also surviving. We're doing a pretty decent job of maintaining that biodiversity.
60% of Arkansas's land remains forested. When Europeans settled the state, 95% of the state was forested.
Next weekend, hundreds of veterans will be in Fayetteville for the Veterans Golden Age Games. Sarah McBride, public affairs specialist for the Veterans Healthcare System of the Ozarks, says the Golden Age Games are the premier senior adaptive rehabilitation program in the country.
What this basically means is that it's for veterans 55 years and older, and they compete in several different events. We've got bowling and cycling, javelin, discus, dominoes, checkers. They compete in these events. Some of them are qualifiers for the Senior Olympics, and it's a way to rehabilitate them, whether they've been through mental health or they've been through our primary care for a physical disability. So it's for veterans that have several abilities and disabilities as well.
She says the competitors in the Golden Age Games are diverse, with participants ranging in age from 55 to 89 or above. This will be the 28th annual Veterans Golden Age Games. Ann McBride says the event holds significance for everyone involved.
Well, for VHSO, it's a huge honor, and we were asked to host this event. So it's really great to participate in Arkansas. We actually haven't had participants in the past from Arkansas, and this year we've got several. And for veterans themselves, it's a rehabilitative event, which is why we host it. It's similar to the wheelchair games that the VA also hosts. It's all in an effort to continue rehabilitation for our military veterans.
More than 700 military veterans are expected to take part in this year's event, including 21 veterans from Arkansas. The event will take place Saturday, June 28th at locations throughout Fayetteville. We'll have more on the Golden Age Games in an in-depth story next week.
Last week, Fayetteville Ward 4 Alderman Rhonda Adams announced she wouldn't be seeking re-election this year. And earlier this week, someone else stepped forward with intentions of filling the seat. Mike Emery, who ran unsuccessfully in 2012, announced that he would run for the Ward 4 Position 1 seat in this year's election. With Emery's announcement, candidates have announced intentions to run in each of the four city council races up for grabs in this year's election.
The Northwest Arkansas Naturals are starting the second half of the minor league season in first place. The Nats defeated the Arkansas Travelers last night 3-2 in Springdale to open the new part of the season.
Tonight's weather forecast calls for partly cloudy conditions with lows around 73. Mostly sunny tomorrow with a slight chance of showers and thunderstorms and highs from 87 in Northwest Arkansas to 91 in the Arkansas River Valley. Partly cloudy tomorrow night with lows around 71. This is Ozarks at Large. Yesterday, members of the Springdale Chamber of Commerce made public a campaign they want to use to propel dramatic job growth for the city. Ozarks at Large's Kyle Kellums was at the announcement in downtown Springdale and has this report.
What if they gave a press conference and everybody showed up? That's not quite what happened yesterday afternoon in downtown Springdale, but a press conference to announce a more than $2.5 million initiative by the city's Chamber of Commerce certainly attracted more observers than anticipated.
Good afternoon. This is an exciting group. We didn't expect quite so many people.
Lisa Ray is the chair of the Springdale Chamber of Commerce. Word about the chamber's pending press conference had been on Twitter and Facebook all morning, and several members of the press and several more members of the community showed up. But far from being taken aback, she used the opportunity to make a parallel for the city's recent fortunes.
It's amazing what social media can do because we have seen a huge movement. All the things we've been trying to move forward for years have suddenly really taken hold, and wonderful things are happening.
That list could include, but not be limited to, recent purchases of vacant downtown buildings, the city leading the state in new job creation, the near completion of the section of the Razorback Greenway that will run through downtown Springdale, and a more than $800,000 grant from the Walton Family Foundation for a mountain bike trail. Yesterday, the Springdale Chamber took time to unveil its plan to keep momentum, and that word was used a lot yesterday, building. Perry Webb, the president and CEO of the chamber, explained the four-part proposal titled Ignite Springdale that will, organizers hope, raise investments of more than $2.5 million.
We're going to create about 3,750 primary new jobs in this community using these funds. That will lead to indirect jobs, which total jobs will total about 6,300, almost 6,400 new jobs. About $200 million in new payroll annually. So these people will receive $200 million in payroll which leads to about $118 million more of disposable income that will be spent inside these city limits.
The four initiatives in the plan are ambitious. Goals include 250 new technology jobs, more than a dozen manufacturing expansions or new industry locations, and six new Springdale-based technology businesses, all by the end of 2017. Perry Webb says the goals have been hammered out through committee meetings and discussions with business owners and chamber members. Webb says more than half the money has been committed by business interests connected to Springdale.
And in the perfect model, you go public when you reach the halfway point in your fundraising. So we have about 1.4 in commitments right now that we're happy to announce of the 2.6 million in campaign funds. These funds will be used to do very specific things, and a lot of feasibility work was done to really identify what the impacts could be.
He says there are two very tangible ways to keep score on the progress of these economic initiatives: the number of people working and sales tax revenues collected.
That's what this is about. If that's the measurement that we're going to be measured by, then that's the measurement we're going to address in this campaign in order to make sure that that economic development is taking place in the maximum way.
Lisa Ray, the chamber chair, says some of the hangover effects from the economic crash of 2008 are finally evaporating, and businesses appear ready to invest some of their money in the chamber's campaign.
Now when we go out and ask businesses, you know, hey, if you want to make Springdale a better place, would you be willing to commit $10,000 or $100,000? We have been asking what we feel like the size of the business can handle. And we're asking that, you know, you can make a contribution over 4 years. So if they ask for $100,000, we're just saying $25,000 a year, but you can make a difference with workforce technology and quality of life and things that are important to really for Springdale to be the kind of place that all of us want it to continue to be.
Ignite Springdale reaches far and includes other goals such as elevate Springdale as a hometown of choice for professionals moving here and complete a community workforce skills assessment. Other objectives are more measurable, like that one to attract six new Springdale-based technology businesses. Perry Webb, the president and CEO of the chamber, says the city has specific plans toward attracting those interests.
First, you have to identify potential customers. And so you have to identify those companies that are looking at the region or engaged currently in the region. A obvious great place to start looking is the University of Arkansas's Research and Technology Center. To have a relationship with that group and to understand what they're actually having coming out of that facility gives us an opportunity to put packages together for them and identify the possibilities. There's also a seed capital part of that, that, you know, if we identify investors who are willing to put money into investments, it always plays well for the community, and part of that is involved in this also.
Lisa Ray, the chair of the chamber, says now that Ignite Springdale is going public, after already raising about half the money, she expects the momentum to continue. And she offers a bit of advice to people inside and outside the city limits.
I'll tell you, if I knew an investor who wanted to buy property at a really good value and do something incredible with it, the time is now. And I think that some of those investors missed their opportunity in Bentonville, missed their opportunity in Fayetteville or Rogers. And so for a lot of folks, you know, right now, you can buy a property or lease a property at a fairly decent rate, but how's that going to look a year or 2 years down the line when all of these wonderful things are happening in downtown Springdale?
For Ozarks at Large, I'm Kyle Kellums.
Hi, everyone. I'm Pat Mitchell-Worley. And coming up next time on Bill Street Caravan, we'll spend the entire program with Amy Levere. We'll also continue our feature host segments with Poppy Tooker exploring the history of food and the blues. That's all coming up next time on Bill Street Caravan.
Tune in Friday night beginning at 8 to 91.3 FM.
In Arkansas and across the nation, there was major political activity last week, and Washington, D.C. seemed to be ground zero. House Majority Leader Eric Cantor was surprisingly beaten in his primary against an underfunded Tea Party candidate. Plus, Hillary Clinton reemerged on the national stage, a prelude to 2016, as she rolled out a new memoir. Roby Brock from our content partner, Talk Business and Politics, recently caught up via satellite to talk politics with Jonathan Martin, national political correspondent with the New York Times and a former senior writer at Politico.
Let's begin with this shocking defeat of Eric Cantor. Multiple theories on why he lost. I kind of subscribe to the theory that he really kind of lost touch with his district and his constituents. What's your take?
I think there's a lot to that, Roby. I think that he spent a lot of time around the country, especially in Washington and New York, trying to raise money for and campaign for some of his colleagues or would-be colleagues, which was his role as the number two man in the House leadership. But the problem is that when you do that, you tend to take your eye off the ball. And for any member of Congress, that means your own home district or your own home state. And I think he was so caught up in doing that and trying to become speaker that he ran into some problems back home. He also antagonized a few folks back home in some really parochial local disputes that perhaps didn't seem to matter too much. But when you're talking about a small scale primary level turnout, it's not a lot of voters. Those kinds of personal things can really matter.
All right, and there was no shortage of analysis in the New York Times this week. I counted like at least 15, maybe 20 stories that you guys had covering all this. One of yours, which I really enjoyed, I'm going to pull a quote from something you wrote. Yet to conservatives, Mr. Cantor's defeat was only the latest and loudest evidence that Republican leaders are detached from the rank and file of a party that wants confrontation rather than compromise. Tell me how Cantor's defeat feeds into this equation now in terms of the congressional agenda, congressional dialogue, and maybe this fall's political races.
Well, I think if you look at the actual agenda this year, Roby, there doesn't seem to be much that's going to happen in Washington besides maybe passing some spending bills. Talking to people here, immigration reform seems to be DOA for the year. So I think policymaking will largely be stymied for this year. And look, we'll see what happens this fall in the congressional elections. Most folks think the Republicans will keep the House and that the Senate's really in play. I think there's a scenario where, especially if somebody like Tom Cotton in Arkansas knocks off an incumbent Democrat, Mark Pryor, where you could see the Republicans take back the Senate next year. And if that's the case, what does that mean for the final 2 years of President Obama's term if you had true divided government? A totally GOP-controlled Congress and a Democrat in the White House, would that mean more gridlock for two more years, or would the voters demand some kind of conciliation and compromise? I think it remains to be seen, but the Cantor upset, I think, for the Republicans at least, is going to encourage their members of Congress to be much more gun-shy when it comes to compromise, when it comes to trying to get big things done. If Eric Cantor lost, who was seen in Washington as a pretty conservative figure, well, I think you're going to see folks in the GOP rank and file in Congress thinking twice before they cut deals.
A little bit of a egalitarian thought on my part here, but I mean, American compromise, is it dead in Washington, D.C.? We just haven't seemed to be able to find any big deals. Hillary Clinton said this week, without compromise, you don't have a democracy.
Right. She said you have a theocracy even, or an autocracy. She was pretty tough. Is it dead? At the moment, yes, it is. The country's polarized. Washington is polarized. The two sides are fairly dug in. And Republicans especially have pretty clear political incentives vis-a-vis these primaries not to give in much to President Obama. So I think for this year, the answer is yes. Does the landscape look different in President Obama's last 2 years when he really wants to create more of a legacy for himself and when the Republicans are looking forward towards 2016 and taking back the White House? Keep in mind something very important here. The Republicans increasingly are a strong congressional party. They got a lock on the House majority, at least in the short term, and they might take back the Senate next year because of how the country is laid out in terms of political loyalties across the country. But the Republicans are weaker when it comes to national politics, when it comes to the White House. And Democrats right now, Roby, look to be a stronger White House party. And so I think you could see a scenario, at least for a while, where you've got divided government just because of how the country is split now politically and geographically, where you've got a lot of strength in Congress for Republicans, a lot of Republican seats, because there's a lot of conservative states. But overall, nationally, The country's pretty moderate, and on some issues becoming even more moderate, which helps Democrats nationally keep the White House.
All right, I got about 60 seconds per question for my last two questions here. Hillary Clinton, how quickly does she get in after November elections?
Yeah, well, speaking of national elections, right? Look, Hillary Clinton is somebody who I think Democrats will look to, who could be formidable in terms of keeping that national coalition that President Obama has created. In terms of her timing, look, I think by deciding to do this book in June of 2014, she is signaling that she's not going to wait too long. Roby, there was some speculation that she would push this thing back for as long as possible, deep into 2015 or even early 2016. The fact that she's now reemerging with this book and the fact that she'll be on the campaign trail this fall, we presume, with Bill Clinton, says to me that she is not going to stay out of public life for that much longer here, and that we'll know something by the early part of next year in terms of her intentions.
All right, I can't let you go without talking about the U.S. Senate race down here that's been the big focus in Washington, D.C., yeah. Pryor versus Cotton. Since we've last talked, been several polls come out that have shown Mark Pryor competitive in this race. There have been a couple of polls in the last couple of days showing Cotton with some leads. They have had a little bit of a partisan slant to him. But the fact that the race is competitive, what's the reaction in Washington, D.C. to the fact that Pryor's still alive?
Yeah. Oh, I think among the Republicans privately, there is concern about Cotton's campaign and Cotton as a candidate. And if you look at his ads and the fact that he has tried a few different times now to sort of personalize himself, humanize himself with various family members, I think it sort of speaks to the challenge he has in trying to relate to Arkansans. So you do hear the Republicans privately talking about that. Democrats are feeling good as of right now that Pryor is still very much in this thing. But Democrats privately concede that it's going to be awfully tough for Pryor to get the number of Romney voters, rather, that he needs in 2014. It's tough for a Democrat to win statewide in a federal race in Arkansas because you have to get so many folks that vote nationally for Republicans for the White House. So I think Democrats are aware of that challenge. But I think the fact that it's still competitive in June, unlike, for example, Roby, the race 4 years ago between Blanche Lincoln and John Bozeman, at least in the short term, is good news for Democrats.
That was Roby Brock from Talk Business and Politics, speaking with Jonathan Martin, national political correspondent with The New York Times. Support for Talk Business and Politics on Ozarks at Large is provided by AT&T, challenging drivers to take the pledge to never text and drive. No text is worth the risk. More at itcanwait.com. And Bank of the Ozarks, committed to helping business owners succeed by combining the tools and services businesses need with accessible experience and knowledge. More information at bankozarks.com.
And the Electric Cooperatives of Arkansas. Diversity is the key to reliability and affordability. From the state's largest industrial user to a home at the end of a long country road, the Electric Cooperatives of Arkansas serve members with a stable supply of electricity backed up with fuel diversity: coal, oil, natural gas, hydropower, and renewables. More at AECC.com. And the Arkansas State Chamber of Commerce and Associated Industries of Arkansas. More at ArkansasStateChamber.com. It is Wednesday, June 18th, 2014, and this is Ozarks at Large. I'm Antoinette Grajeda.
I'm Christina Karnatz.
And with us now, Becca Martin Brown, features editor at Northwest Arkansas Newspapers.
So we're going to talk about Black Music Month.
Okay.
And movies.
I like movies.
Gwen Kelly is the organizer of Black Music Month in Northwest Arkansas, and she was reminded that there are lots of great movies that feature Black musicians, Black music, as it were. The Wiz, Car Wash, Purple Rain, The Preacher's Wife. And so she has decided this year to celebrate Black Music Month. There will be a music and movie combination.
Wonderful.
The first show was Thursday. Sorry, we missed that. But also coming are Standing in the Shadow of Motown on June 24th and the Oscar-winning 20 Feet from Stardom on June 26th.
I want to see that. That sounds really good.
It's supposed to be amazing. And they're both going to be screened at NWAC Shoemaker Center. They're both free. 20 Feet from Stardom chronicles the backup singers.
Mm-hmm. It's a documentary.
Yeah, yeah. Both are. Who never got any fame, but were part of a lot of great success. It should be a lot of fun, and Kelly hopes the film show the contributions of African Americans to our music fabric. You can find out more at bmmcarkansas.com.
Becca Martin Brown, features editor with Northwest Arkansas Newspapers.
Thank you so much, Zeke Taylor, for being on the Tin Roof Project here at Tales from the South.
I thought it was safe to have a little morning cocktail. I figured that the whiskey would calm my nerves, while the coffee would keep me somewhat sober. Every so often, I ventured into the bathroom to look at myself in the mirror, admiring my new look, while at the same time regretting my action.
Tales from the South, Saturday afternoon at 3:30 on KUAF.
Paula Morell from Tales from the South will host a half-day storytelling workshop called Tales on the Rails Sunday afternoon in Rogers. The Village Writing School, based in Eureka Springs, is sponsoring the event, which will take place on a train car at 1st and Poplar Street. A one-hour train ride departing at 1 p.m. is included in the workshop. Pre-registration is required and class size is limited. The cost to participate is $35, and you can register at villagewritingschool.com. For more information, email Allison Taylor Brown at me.com or call 479-292-3665.
There are a couple of deadlines local artists should be aware of. Friday is the last day for artists to submit their designs for a mural at the Springdale Aquatic Center. The project is part of the Springdale Art Initiative, an effort by Team Springdale and the Springdale Parks and Recreation Department to introduce art to the town's public parks and trails. There is no cost to apply. The selected artist will receive a $1,000 stipend for his or her supplies, time, skills, mural design, and installation thanks to Arvest Bank. The Springdale Parks and Recreation Department will provide all of the necessary paint for the execution of the mural spaces. Artists are responsible for mixing the necessary colors and must provide their own rollers, brushes, and trays. More information is available at teamspringdale.com.
The Northwest Arkansas Hispanic Heritage Festival will take place October 4th and 5th at May Farm, and its annual poster contest is underway. Officials will select the entry that best reflects the festival theme of a celebration of Hispanic American heritage today. The winner will receive $250, and his or her poster will be used in festival-related marketing. All entries will be displayed during the festival, which is celebrating the country of Mexico this year. All entries must be submitted to the Fayetteville Chamber of Commerce by July 1st. For an entry form and more information, visit FayettevilleAR.com.
In the coming days, there are a number of opportunities to eat and drink in support of local organizations. Tomorrow, the Eureka Springs Downtown Network is hosting cocktails for a cause at Pied Piper Pub to support Turpentine Creek Wildlife Refuge. Admission is $10 at the door, and 33% of the proceeds from 5 to 7 will be split between ESDN and Turpentine Creek. Visit EurekaSpringsDowntown.com for more information.
From 5 to 10 Friday evening, Fayetteville Metro Kiwanis is hosting a fundraiser at Yum Yo's Frozen Yogurt, which is located at 1267 Steamboat Drive, Suite 1 in Fayetteville. Simply mention the Kiwanis Club at the cash register, and Yum Yo's will donate 15% of the night's proceeds to the organization. Proceeds will support high school scholarships, food baskets, and children's charities in Northwest Arkansas. More information is available by searching for Fayetteville Metro Kiwanis on Facebook.
The Drink the Garden event is scheduled for Saturday night at Peel Mansion in Bentonville. The event includes drinks created by mixologists from 11, The Hive, Pink House Alchemy, and 28 Springs. Airship Coffee will provide other beverages. Admission is $35, and the event lasts from 4 to 7 p.m. at Peel Mansion Museum. Learn more at peelcompton.org or at the Peel Mansion Museum and Heritage Gardens Facebook page.
The Bella Vista Village Property Owners Association will host a movie night Saturday at the Metfield Pavilion, located at 1 Hilltop Drive. The free, family-friendly event begins at 8:30 p.m. with the showing of Despicable Me 2. Free drinks and popcorn will be available. Those who plan on attending should bring their own lawn chairs or blankets. To reach Metfield Pavilion, take US 71 to Trafalgar Road. Turn right on Commonwealth Road and then take another right on Hilltop Drive. For more, visit bellavistapoa.com. In Northwest Arkansas, it seems like the weather can change in an instant. One day it's sunny and 75, the next a cold front moves in and it's 45 and raining. During severe weather, you can get weather warnings on your phone, radio, or television. You may even hear this sound echoing through the air. The National Weather Service, which is headquartered in Silver Spring, Maryland, is the group responsible for issuing weather warnings. The organization employs about 5,000 people in 122 weather forecast offices across the country. The office in charge of issuing forecasts for Northwest Arkansas is located in a tall, nondescript building on the outskirts of Tulsa, Oklahoma. The structure is comprised of alternating layers of dark windows and a grayish concrete. The Tulsa National Weather Service office occupies about 10,000 square feet on the third floor. A National Weather Service display that includes old weather instruments, posters, and a tornado simulator greets visitors stepping off the elevator. After entering the dark wooden doors to the right, walk past the receptionist desk and photos of tornadoes on the wall, and you will find yourself in the office of meteorologist in charge, Stephen F. Piltz. Piltz has been in Tulsa since 1990, and the office has been located in this building since 1993. Piltz is originally from Murfreesboro, Illinois, which was struck by the country's deadliest tornado in 1925. According to the National Weather Service, what the organization calls the Tri-State Tornado tore a 219-mile path across Missouri, Illinois, and Indiana. The tornado resulted in 695 deaths, 234 of which occurred in Murfreesboro, a record for a single community from such a disaster. Piltz says this, combined with an F4 tornado that struck the town about 4 years before his birth, really had an effect on Murfreesboro residents.
Growing up, you could just tell that the town really kind of freaked out every time it got stormy in the spring. And I think that has made an impression like, wow, the folks really are worried about that. And people who know weather can control the mood of a town, and it kind of just built from there.
Piltz's interest in weather eventually blossomed into a career in meteorology. The Tulsa office employs about 25 people, and there is someone there 24/7. There are typically three people in the office at any given time, but Piltz says this number can double or triple on severe weather nights. The Tulsa office is responsible for creating day-to-day forecasts and issuing weather warnings for 7 counties in northwest Arkansas and 25 counties in eastern Oklahoma. Piltz explains they work on a sister station concept, so if one office goes down, another one can back it up. If the Tulsa office wasn't functional, for example, an office in Norman, Oklahoma would take over. Exiting Piltz's office and heading down a hallway to your left, you pass the library and break room. Further down the hall, blue cubicle walls appear to your right and to your left. The River Forecast Center is located on the other side of the left wall.
They deal with the water issues from Colorado back across Kansas, Oklahoma, into West Arkansas and North Texas. Since it's kind of dry at the moment, I don't think a whole lot's going on, although they still have hourly analysis they have to do, and they kind of get involved in some of the drought things too, because they know what the water levels are and they keep track of all that, and they can tell communities, yes, you're this low and this is kind of what you need to be better, and so they can help with water supply things. The weather forecast office is all over here. Say hi, Ray.
Hi.
The cubicles on the right are positioned in an open layout, so everyone can easily communicate from one desk to another. Pilt says this is by design.
The openness seems to work best. We've seen the studies, and we joke about it some, that it's the noisy cockpits that survive when airliners are in trouble. And typically, if a cockpit's quiet, that's the airliner that's more in trouble, more likely not to catch everything it needs to catch. It may have a better chance of crashing, but the cockpit that where there's constant chatter, someone always bringing up an idea, someone's always pointing something out, that tends to be the cockpit that survives, and that's kind of the mode we operate in. Generally, the noisier, the better things are. It's when the room gets really quiet is something's gone wrong, that suddenly the storms aren't doing what they're supposed to be doing, and now we're all intensely looking at things as opposed to chit-chatting back and forth. So you can tell that a noisy room is a good room for us generally.
One wall of this room is lined with large windows, which meteorologist in charge Steve Piltz says offers a pretty good view when a nasty storm is rolling in. Across the way, 8 computer monitors sit atop the white tabletop of a large corner workstation. A handful of flat-screen televisions are mounted to the upper part of the cubicle walls. This is where a lot of data is collected and analyzed. As Pilt sits down to look at an image on one of the computer screens, he talks to a colleague about what looks like a large swath of color hovering over Oklahoma.
We send out 2 radar pulses, one this way and one this way, and we compare the results of the two. And right now in this purple area, we're getting more signal back from the horizontal than we are the vertical. So that tells us whatever we're seeing on the radar isn't a raindrop, it's not a cloud, it's something long. So it's probably a bug of some sort. This also tells us that the signal's kind of chaotic, and if this were a cloud, if this were rain or snow, this would all be one solid color, pretty much like this grapey purple color up in here. But since this is all scattered and low like this, that tells us that it's not just uniform, it's something kind of chaotic. And so we know from this it's pretty much not meteorological, it's not water vapor or ice or anything, and we know from this that it's something long. And I also know that this is the way the wind's blowing where these radar echoes are. It's coming from the southwest going to the northeast, but the stuff's coming this way, so it's kind of going against the wind too, so it's not drifting in the wind like a cloud would. So everything points to it's bugs.
In addition to radar, the Tulsa office has access to satellite imagery. The image on the screen was created by a thermal sensor on a satellite, and without it, Pilt says, they'd lose track of things at night. The thermal imagery is also helpful for spotting wildfires. Pilt says there have been circumstances when they've noticed a thermal signature in a rural area and notified authorities. This desk is also the area where meteorologists send out weather warnings. Pilt says sometimes it takes less than a second after striking the enter key before the warning is broadcast on television and radio. In addition to regular weather forecasts, this office is also in charge of producing specialized airport forecasts, which look at the height of clouds, visibility, and wind.
If we inappropriately forecast the weather too low, we've caused all the airlines to carry more fuel. We've caused them all to designate specific alternate airports that they will go to if they can't get in. And so we're cognizant of the fact that if we make a bad forecast, we've cost airlines money.
Because they have access to computer models as well as radar and satellite imagery, Steve Piltz says he often ends up with more data than you can shake a stick at. The trick is to pull useful parts from the different data sets to create as accurate a forecast as possible. Meteorologists in the Tulsa office communicate with Northwest Arkansas meteorologists, watch local television stations, listen to reports from local residents, and watch weather reports on social media to help shape their decisions.
The radar in the end only sees what's in the beam, and then the earth curves, and so at some point the radar beam is gaining altitude off the ground, and so we really don't know what's at ground level. We can only say what's going on maybe at 2,000, 3,000, 4,000, 5,000 feet. So we may see rotation at 3,000 feet, but not know if it's actually a tornado on the ground. Or we may see a storm that is producing hail, but we don't really know what's finally reached the ground. So having them feedback information is great. So it's really, when the weather gets bad, meteorologists won't turn down information.
Walking through a door at the back of this room, you'll find yourself in another room full of computer servers that are stored in tall black metal cases.
And this is just all the guts to the computers out front. So like this is the brains of the Fort Smith radar, which over the years electronics just keeps getting smaller and smaller. But that's, the signal comes from Fort Smith and it gets processed in here, and then we turn it back around and it shows up on your smartphone, on the web page, shows up on the TV stations if they're using the Weather Service radars. So all the guts to everything is back in here.
So the radar is in Fort Smith, but the information comes here?
Mm-hmm. So yeah, all the raw data comes up by a T1 circuit and then gets processed here. So in a sense, at least a part of the Fort Smith radar lives here.
Tulsa, by the way, has its own radar, which is located about 15 miles to the east along Highway 412. While Steve Piltz and his team work tirelessly to give the best forecast possible, it's important to remember that sometimes nature's just going to do whatever it wants.
It's a rewarding thing, but it's also very humbling because you know that you shouldn't be overly proud about any one thing that you've done, because nature will fix that within the next few days. And so if you think, boy, we nailed that snow forecast, that probably means the next week we're going to mess something up. And so you know to work hard and be proud, but at the same time, don't get too excited that you think that you're all that, because you're really not. Nature still humbles all of us when it comes to bad weather.
If you'd like to check out the Northwest Arkansas Tulsa office, it will be hosting an open house Saturday, September 20th. For more information, visit weather.gov/Tulsa. This is Ozarks at Large.
In one day, April 25th, 2011, more than 6 inches of rain fell on Prairie Grove. That's around 1.5 times what you'd normally expect for the whole month. According to the National Weather Service in Tulsa, during 7 days from April 21st through 28th that year, portions of Benton and Washington counties were inundated with between 12 and 16 inches of rain. The widespread flash flooding led to 5 deaths in northwest Arkansas. And here's the bad news. According to a report released by climate scientists last month, extreme rain events like that are the new normal. The National Climate Assessment, put together by 300 experts and guided by a 60-member federal advisory committee, says the amount of precipitation falling in heavy rainstorms is up by as much as 71% since the mid-20th century in some parts of the country. Ozarks at Large's Sarah Birmingham recently spoke to Steve Boss, professor of environmental dynamics and sustainability at the University of Arkansas, who says, welcome to the future.
Globally, the expectation is that under a warming world, that rainfall events will increase in frequency and also intensity worldwide. In our own region, that's expected to be true as well. So we'll see probably more frequent rainfall events, and some of those rainfall events are going to be more intense than we're accustomed to.
So the prediction was there. For a while, it's been there for a while that we were going to have this more intense rain. Not just more rain, but these sort of cloudbursts. Thought it was going to happen. It is happening. But the rate at which they have increased is some pretty big numbers in terms of how quickly that's ramping up.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, and when they talk about these extreme precipitation events, we're talking about the upper 1% of rainfall events. And so the most extreme events, the top 1%, those are the events that we're seeing become more extreme. And those events have increased in intensity, or the amount of precipitation they produce, by, in our area, about 25 to 27%. It's pretty significant.
And why does a warming world mean these sort of more intense bursts?
So in a warming world, a warmer atmosphere is capable of holding more water vapor. And so as the atmosphere achieves saturation under those conditions with respect to water vapor, more water vapor then can precipitate out.
Rather than it just being necessarily a constant drizzle, as someone from England is very familiar with, why is it sort of that intense, those intense bursts, the kind of downpours that we've seen here in Fayetteville, where it's really caused the kind of runoff that no storm drain system can handle?
Sure. Well, again, in an atmosphere where you're getting more absolute quantities of moisture, we live in the mid-latitude region here where our weather patterns are dominated by frontal systems of various kinds. And those frontal systems, we're accustomed to kind of downpours anyway. Some, you know, intense summer thunderstorm pattern is kind of the pattern that we expect. In a world where we're still going to be dominated by frontal weather systems and there's more water vapor in the atmosphere, there's going to be more instability in the atmosphere, so you're going to get greater amounts of convective activity and convective thunderstorms, and those storms are just going to have more water in total to drop, and so they're going to do that. And obviously we have seen increases in precipitation here. I mean, I think locally we've talked to people that they kind of imagine that, gee, there's a lot of more intense storms here, and that's not their imagination, that's actually real, that's happening.
Yeah, there's something about, you know, as is often discussed, the difference between weather and climate. A single weather event, someone will say, oh, you know, is this climate change? And of course, climate scientists say, well, we don't know. But in terms of the trends, that's accurate. Then when someone sort of makes a broad observation, people who've lived in a place for a long time and they notice things about the seasons maybe and the character of the weather.
That's right. That's exactly right. When you make those longer-term generalizations, you're generalizing about some experience you're having in the climate system. And in climatology, the standard time interval that climatologists use to define climate is 30 years.
There are also observations that the rate of warming seems to have slowed. Why do we know why that is, and do we expect that to continue?
Yes. Over the last decade or so, the rate of warming seems to have slowed somewhat. And part of that is that we're now making observations, or we have observational data from the oceans. And much of the heat that's been trapped on Earth is being trapped in the oceans right now. And the expectation is that that will be a process that may go on for some time. But eventually, that process will slow down, too. And once that happens, we will go back to accelerated rate of warming that we'd seen throughout most of the 20th century. And so the expectation of the scientific community is that when warming comes back on pace, it's going to come back with a vengeance, and we're going to see very rapid warming. And we have other things going on in the climate system right now that are, I think, very telling and a little bit scary in some regards. In the Arctic in particular, we're seeing excessive amounts of warming in the Arctic and at both poles, really, but it's most pronounced in the Arctic right now. We're seeing rapid declines of the summer sea ice in the Arctic Ocean. I was just reading a paper yesterday. They're projecting forward in time, looking at just the historical rate of decline of Arctic sea ice in the summer, that they expect there may well be no sea ice in the Arctic Ocean by the summer of 2016. And so that's really close. And once the Arctic Ocean is ice-free, worldwide climate and weather patterns will change very dramatically. And we don't know what that world looks like because we haven't had a world with no ice in the Arctic Ocean before.
Ever.
Not in human history.
Based on the information that we currently have, based on what came out through the National Climate Assessment, what can we expect in our region? I mean, you've mentioned that we can expect those more intense rainfalls, more rain, more extremes, I suppose, because we just had a really, really, really cold winter, right?
That's right. That's exactly right. And you know, the winter was very, very cold for us and across much of the United States. Elsewhere in the world, it was excessively warm. And if you can think back to the January, February timeframe in Australia, which is, of course, their summertime, the Australian Open tennis match was called off, and they had to play matches at night because it was too hot in the day to play. That's never happened either. And so worldwide, you know, the rest of the world has been much, much warmer than normal. We just happen to be cold this year. We're not likely to be as cold, you know, next year. That cold spot may be somewhere else on the world. That's kind of part of the variability that we see in the climate system on an annual basis. But overall, the globe is warming, and we're on track right now for 2014 potentially to become the warmest year on record.
Is there anything people can do to sort of prepare?
I think there's a lot of things that we can do to expect changes to take place and beware that we may see an agricultural system that becomes more drought-prone or more flood-prone, and to sort of be a little bit proactive in thinking forward. You know, pay attention to climate predictions. I mean, we do have climate prediction scientists, and we do make predictions out 3 or 4 months in advance. Try to plan ahead, try to pay attention to those things. Our predictive ability is getting better. It's not perfect by any stretch, but it's getting better over time. And I think that we need to start paying more attention to those things and be thinking about, you know, the types of crops that we might grow here and how we might manage these more extreme climate events. If droughts become more frequent and flood events become more frequent, we're going to have to adapt our agriculture to accommodate those things. And we know when droughts are most likely to occur. We know when floods are most likely to occur. And we may have to shift our growing season somewhat, and that'll be possible in a warming world to do that.
And then just in terms of the geography of where we are, you're talking about the frontal systems that affect us. Why is it sort of that, you know, there's often the definitions are west of the Mississippi or east of the Rockies? Why are those things significant?
Well, so in our part of the world here, east of the Great Plains and really in through much of the Great Plains, we come under influence of circulation from the Gulf of Mexico. So when we have southwesterly winds here, the clash of this warm, moist air coming northward from the Gulf of Mexico, interacting with air coming from the west, which is generally cooler and drier air. And when those two air masses get together, you get great instability in the atmosphere, and you drive short-term but very intense convective events. So the big thunderstorms we see in the summertime, or particularly in the springtime and sometimes in the fall here, are driven by those interactions in the atmosphere. I think it's important that people, you know, really start to pay attention to the climate science. I think the climate science community is getting better at communicating results to the general public, and I think it's time that if you haven't paid attention to it, you know, start paying attention to it and, you know, be prepared to be as adaptable as you can be going forward.
That was Steve Boss, Professor of Environmental Dynamics and Sustainability at the University of Arkansas, speaking with Ozarks at Large's Sarah Burningham. You can read the National Climate Assessment online at nca2014.globalchange.gov.
I'm Robin Young. What should you be doing with your banana peels and eggshells? We'll visit the not-so-simple choice between compost and the garbage disposal. Maybe not the garbage disposal. That's next time on Year and Now from NPR and WBUR Boston.
Here and Now, coming up next here on KUAF.
And this is KUAF 91.3 FM, Fayetteville, Fort Smith, Bentonville, and Peanut.
Ozarks at Large is a production of KUAF. I'm Antoinette Grajeda.
I'm Christina Karnatz.
Tune in tomorrow at noon for an all-new edition of Ozarks at Large. Christina will be back along with her co-host, Kyle Kellums. What's something we can look forward to on tomorrow's show?
We have our next installment in the Locally Made series. Mm-hmm. I went and visited with an artist yesterday. She does jewelry.
Oh.
And really, I don't know why I'm surprised that it was so good. But I mean, it was really, really, really pretty stuff. She uses stones and metal, and so we can look forward to hearing from Nancy tomorrow.
Well, we are looking forward to hearing about that, and we do look forward to hearing from our listeners. If you ever have a story idea for us, maybe for Locally Made or something like that, drop us a line at ozarksatlarge@gmail.com. And just this reminder that you can get Ozarks at Large a number of different ways.
That's right. You can listen at our website, KUAF.com, live during this noon edition or the 7 o'clock edition. Mm-hmm. You can also listen at 5 o'clock at KUAF3, which you can listen online or with an HD radio.
Mm-hmm. And then we also have a podcast because we know our listeners are busy on the go people. You can get the podcast through your smartphone, go to the App Store, and you can find Ozarks at Large there and then listen to us at your convenience.
Mm-hmm. Or just at our website, ozarksatlarge.com. You can search there for a story if you missed one but you knew it was on last week. You can put in the keywords and find it right there. Or an entire show, you can find the date and go there too.
Absolutely. Want to make sure we keep in touch with all of our listeners. We're going to end today's show with a song by Jim Lauderdale. The name of the song is The Train That Carried My Gal Away From Town. He will be at George's Friday night, and tickets are $20. More information at georgesmajesticlounge.com. Thanks again for listening, and have a fantastic Wednesday.
That train that carried my girl.